Okay, I'll just begin by letting you know that I'm Terry Thornton, and I work here at the Modern in the Education Department, and I'm really, really happy to be a part of this new program, Sundays with Andy, for the run of the Andy Warhol exhibition. We have had and will continue to have an artist here every Sunday at 1 o'clock to talk about the work of Andy Warhol in relation to the exhibition we have upstairs, which I think is kind of phenomenal on two accounts. One, that that you're going to get a perspective, any of you that want to continue to come each time, will get a perspective, various perspectives on Andy Warhol, which I think is so interesting, especially given kind of the nature of Andy Warhol and how open to interpretation his work seems to be. But in addition to that, I think it's pretty remarkable that the DFW Metroplex hosts so many talented artists that it was no trouble to come up with 14, and in fact, I could have gone past the 14 weeks easily, and because of the success of this program, we're hoping to continue it with other exhibitions. So just know that this Sundays are the day to come to the Modern. We have been fortunate to have, as I said, all of these great artists, and today certainly is no exception. We have Thomas Fulmer here. Thomas, just to give you a brief background so it gives you a little insight into his insights, you know, if you know a little bit about him and the type of work that he does. Thomas received his MFA from Carnegie Mellon, a program that's very interdisciplinary, so he was able to investigate a lot of media, including sound and video and such. And he was, in fact, while there, he was an artist assistant during the Carnegie International for the sound artist Janet Cardiff. So he has that experience. He is currently the director of educational programming at the Rachofsky House, which is the collection of Cindy and Howard Rachofsky in Dallas. Some of you are nodding. You know that phenomenal collection and the phenomenal house, Richard Meyer House, that houses it. Well, if you go there, you're sure to see Thomas because he's your contact. He also was the assistant curator of education here at the Modern from 2002 to 2004, so he knows this building and this collection very well. We also have the advantage of that insight. Let's see. Thomas is also doing curating, working with the Rachofsky collection to get it out of the house and out into more public spaces. He's done an exhibition up at UNT, and most recently he worked with Christina Reese at TCU for the exhibition Floor Corner Wall, selected work from the Rachofsky collection at the Fort Worth Contemporary, which is one of TCU's galleries. He also co-curated with Christina Reese the exhibition that received so much critical acclaim, Modern Ruin, in which it was a two-day exhibition that they exhibited with 15 artists. Is that right? 14 or 15 artists for 2 days, went up, came down in a never-before-used Washington Mutual Bank building. It was a fascinating exhibition that actually received coverage on Marketplace, which I thought was really incredible. Thomas, in addition to all of this, is obviously an artist, and that's why he is here today. He's a very good artist. He has been a member of 500X for some time. He recently showed there with an exhibition with also his work and the work of artist Rebecca Carter. Some of you may have seen that exhibition. And he's shown at Road Agent Gallery in Dallas. And if you want to see his work, I believe you can find it at Marty Walker Gallery in Dallas. So that's a whole lot about Thomas, but it ought to give you a little bit of information when you're hearing what he has to tell us about Andy Warhol. So thank you so much for coming, and I'll turn it over to Thomas.
Are we good? Yes. So I actually just, you know, the Warhol show is upstairs, but I wanted to start by talking about this Motherwell painting for a few moments, but I actually love that we started out surrounding this box of money. I think that was kind of like a nice Warhol thing to do. And it's kind of comforting to lean on this before the tour. Like, I was channeling him or something. So anyway, let's go look at this Motherwell painting with us. So everybody scoot up like 10 feet first. There's this weird social thing that happens when people look at art where everybody kind of establishes this kind of line of viewing, which is funny. But this piece you have to look at a little more closely. And I have to say I'm not a big fan of Robert Motherwell, and I'm gonna say a few things that are where I'm going to try to take a little bit of the energy out of Motherwell. But this is a big favorite, and Motherwell's a big part of the modern collection, and I do really love his earlier work. But I just want to... The kind of ideas that I think are really fascinating with Warhol, and the kind of things that I think are really complicated about Warhol, are ideas about the nature of an image and the nature of a reference, and also the nature of a self-reference. So, and also of a representation. So, Warhol, of course, is known, and of course, pop art is known for work that makes a reference to something or that uses a reference to something, meaning a photograph of Marilyn Monroe references the real body, the real, you know, person, Marilyn Monroe. So what Warhol's subject is not Marilyn Monroe, but the photo of Marilyn Monroe, right? We're all up to speed on that. Like, he's not really making work about Marilyn Monroe, the woman who goes home and eats dinner and brushes her teeth. He's making work about the photo that gets distributed around to everybody and that we all look at and that we all start to kind of love and obsess over. So that's the subject of his work. And what I think is kind of funny is that Motherwell, this piece is from the 80s, which is the same time frame as the Warhol show, but Motherwell is doing something similar, and he's at a point in his career and in his life where he's an established, you know, kind of abstract expressionist artist, and he's starting to make references to his own work, and he's starting to self-reference. And so what happens is, you know, he's starting to become more and more distant from the original energy of his work. And in fact, this work, which is a great painting, I think it's an effective, it's a big painting, is kind of a big fake. Because what Motherwell did, this piece, which is called Stephen's Iron Cross or Iron Crown, Stephen's Iron Crown, comes from this series of drawings that Motherwell did of oil paint on paper. These kind of, according to him, quick, energetic drawings of oil paint on paper. And what happens, as I'm sure some of you know, when you oil paint on paper, the oil in the oil paint kind of seeps out into the page and stains the page, right? So when Motherwell makes a big painting of that drawing, so when Motherwell makes a painting that references the drawing that came from that drunk on turpentine energy, he actually kind of fakes out the oil on the page. So that's really just paint that references this oil stain on the page, right? So, and what's, you know, I don't know, this is kind of a big fake of a painting, but you can still love it, which is what you can do with Warhol too. But so what you can see, though, if you look at this more closely, is he even painted the oil stain first, and then he made this big, you know, energetic, you know, big, thick brushstroke on top of it. So he's kind of even painting by numbers here. I'm sorry, but he just is. Like, he just, it's, I mean, it's okay. You can still love it, but he just is. And what's kind of funny about that is it actually reverses the order of the action of the original painting, because the original painting, he made that, you know, that energetic stroke, and then over a lot of time, that oil starts to seep in, you know, after. And here it's the before, you know, so it really inverts the energy of that. And then I just think these, like, squirrely little drips are so funny. Like, they're so out of scale. Like, if, in theory, the brush is about that wide, like, there's no way those drips came from that brush. It's probably, he probably took a little paintbrush and, you know, like, hit it on your finger like you do in grade school with the leaves when you do stencils. Anyway, so, but, I mean, I think this piece just illustrates that point, that it's a kind of mimicking of energy, or a kind of translation of the original. And so I'm kind of obsessed by this idea that references become, well, they take on another life and they become more fluid. So when I say this is a big fake, I don't mean that as an insult, but I just mean that it becomes translated and it becomes something else. And it enters this more fluid world of images and of references. So I mean, that kind of fluidity of like breaking apart from the original, that's where something, it's like it becomes a satellite out in space and it can do all these different things. So think about that, because when we look at the paintings, that the oxidation paintings where somebody peed on the paintings, that's the real version of this, actually. So, so let's go upstairs. So I think we can probably hear now. I just want to stop for just a moment at this piece because this is, in Warhol's, first of all, the title of the show is The Last Decade, and I have to admit that I think that's a little bit of a, it's kind of a morbid title for a show in a sense, because it implies, and I think it, in a funny way, well, it's kind of good and it's kind of not, because it implies that Warhol knew it was the last decade of his life, and that in knowing that it's the last decade of your life, you're going to make a certain kind of work. And of course, Warhol didn't know he was going to die. He died very, uneventfully after gallbladder surgery when he was 58 years old. So, he didn't die suddenly. He wasn't that old. And so, it's not as if he was, at the end of his time on Earth and had these kind of self-reflective moments. Now, what is weird is that Warhol, as I'm sure many or all of you know, was shot, right? Valerie Solanas tried to kill him. And that was when he was about 40. I think that was in 68, and he's born in 28. And so at 40, he had, what you might call, or what you could think of as like one of the biggest midlife crises possible, right? Not only is he 40, but someone tries to kill him. He has this, he's at this point in his life where he's very established as a kind of iconic artist already. So at 40, he does start to become aware of death, and he does start to become obsessed with these notions of mortality. So, the thesis of the show of the last decade is kind of really right and really wrong in some way. But so I would just think of the show as kind of like the late 70s through the late 80s when he died. I think that's a kind of an easier way to register the idea of it in your head. And Warhol said, I think I have the quote on my phone. I'm not sending a text message. I'm just going to look at this quote on my phone. Sorry. So this is what Warhol said about being shot. He says, "Before I was shot, I always thought that I was more half there than all there. I always suspected that I was watching TV instead of living life. People sometimes say that the way things happen in movies is unreal, but actually it's the way things happen in life that's unreal. The movies make emotions look so strong and real, whereas when things really do happen to you, it's like watching television. You don't feel anything." He said, "Right when I was being shot and ever since, I knew that I was watching television. The channel switched, but it's all about television." So I love that idea that, he was making all of this work about these kind of moments and he was so distant from, and then when he shot, it actually felt unreal. Like the most real thing suddenly felt unreal to him. And so this idea, so he starts, the kind of the work in the show has all of these really big ideas in it, like religion, life, death, the body, mortality, that kind of thing. But I just love starting here with the Mona Lisa because it's his way, he's at a point in his life where he knows he's in the art history books, right? So what does he start? One of the things he starts doing is he starts making paintings of, right, not the Mona Lisa, but something in an art history book, right? So he's making, in a funny way, a painting about art history books because he really knows he's already there. And so that's another kind of weird distance, to know that you're a character and to know that you're something that's in a book, and he already knows that he has a life outside himself as a reference or as a, that there's another version of him that lives out there. And he even says, I know I'm a great character. I'm messing up this quote, but something like, "I know I'm a great character, but I don't know what to paint anymore." So he knows. There's a quote in the book where he's talking about one of his shows, and he says, "I know the reviews of the show will be bad, but the reviews of the party will be great." So it's so he knows, he knows that his life is always referenced, whether the work is anything or not. So, I'm going to just kind of put this question in your head, because it's an obvious thing, but I think it's something you can really get excited about, which is, why did he make more than one of these images on the canvas? I mean, we're all just so used to that with Warhol, right? Of course, there's going to be multiples. He almost never does one of anything. And if he does do one of them, he makes a bunch of the one-offs. So I just want to put that in your head with this Mona Lisa, because I just think that's why are there so many of them? We're just used to that. But it's why did he do so many of them? Why did he do them in a grid? Why, and also in contemporary culture, we're just used to that. It's like going to the grocery store and seeing them all on the shelf, right? You just kind of, how to navigate that situation. So let's go look at his wallpaper after that, which is kind of good. So this is a great space, and I love, you know, this is where how and why I kind of started loving this idea for this, you know, this afternoon and this tour of the reference of the self-reference, because Warhol, of course, it's already on the Warhol wallpaper, which is really fantastic. And this is an image of Warhol, a much younger image of him. But these, all of the images on this wall are self-portraits, and they're these kind of funny self-portraits where he's looking at his own death or his own kind of icon status. So there's the photo of him being strangled, the photo of him with the skull, which is, I know there's about 1,000 references in that. And I wore my sweater with the skulls on it to reference the painting. Just to hammer it home. And then the portrait of him, which is part of the myth series. So he's already including himself in the kind of, mythology of American culture with something like Santa Claus or Howdy Doody or Mickey Mouse. Like, he already knows he's up there with these guys, right? So I think that's, you know, it's pretty telling that he's already reflecting on how he will be seen after he dies, right? You know, he's aware that he will have a life after he dies in books and in images, and he's starting to make those images for us, right? I also think, you know, this is a kind of self-reference too, because, not just because it's a self-portrait, but because early on, you know, he made those death and disaster series, right? The car wrecks, the electric chair, the women. The really funny one in the death and disaster series is the women who died of tuna. Do you guys know that Warhol piece? You need to look it up. Do you guys know it? It's this really weird newspaper article about these women who ate these contaminated cans of tuna and died. And so it's like this really sad, but there are these, I don't know, it's really twisted. Because all the other death and disaster series, they're so gruesome that you're kind of like, you can be kind of serious and fascinated, and then you see this image of tuna cans and these two kind of cute women from the 60s, and you're like jarred. But so I feel like he's making his own death and disaster series image for himself, right? So he's referencing not just his own death, but his own work, and he's kind of adding himself to the history of his work at this point very consciously. And then the skull is something that, you know, shows up throughout art history, especially in Dutch Vanitas paintings, and of course there's the image of Hamlet with the skull and contemplating death. Do you guys know the phrase memento mori? It's a Latin term. Some of you know it. So memento mori is, and there are a lot of kind of images in art history, and I think Warhol's making his own memento mori here, but there are a lot of images in art history that come out of this idea of memento mori, which is a Latin phrase that means remember that you must die. And so there are these images that are early on very closely related to religion, with this idea that it's a reminder of your mortality and a reminder that your actions on earth have consequences, and also that life is a kind of frail thing. And so you see skeletons and skulls and paintings of them a lot, and a lot of times they'll be referred to with this term memento mori, remember that you must die. And in fact, you'll see paintings, at times you'll see a painting of a figure and next to it a painting of them as a skeleton, with the idea that, you know, our lives are always kind of overshadowed by this notion of death. And especially for someone who was shot at 40 years old, right? And then, again, I just want to conjure this idea of the reference and the real thing versus what it becomes. But look at the wallpaper, and look at the wallpaper itself as a reference to three things that aren't really there. So the wallpaper is the purple square, which is just a kind of geometric shape. The pink shape, which looks like a torn sheet of paper. You see that? Right? Like, it looks like a corner of a piece of paper that has a torn edge, but it's really silk screened on. And then this is actually a drawing that became a silk screen of Warhol that references the photograph. So all of these three things, maybe not the purple square so much, but have been translated and ultimately become wallpaper, right? So the wallpaper itself, you know, like you can think of old wallpaper with images of landscapes, has this really kind of funny reference. So this is, I love Warhol even, he does great wallpaper, right? So really quickly, just glance over your shoulder. Do you see the little Polaroid of Arnold Schwarzenegger? Flexing, he's signed it. Come look at it real fast, because this is a great way to think about the life of an image. So these are all these great Polaroids that Warhol shot. And so this is the image of Schwarzenegger, which I think is really... Again, this is a way to kind of bring this point home, but the life of images in our culture and the kind of fluid life of images is a pretty amazing kind of world or geography that we're always navigating, because ultimately this is not the guy who is elected governor, right? It's all of the images in between that allowed him to be elected governor, right? If these were the only images, if these were the only things that had life in our culture, images like this, half naked, you know, covered in oil and being really vain, he wouldn't have been elected. But, you know, there are all of these images in between of him in a business suit, looking kind of aged. You know, he's kind of dyeing his hair that weird orange color now. So it's like, you know, there's like, you know, this guy, this image didn't get him elected. It's all of the other images in between. So I think this really kind of brings home this idea that, you know, the life of images and the kind of fluid life of an image have a real power, and also the fact that we can now see this image through him as governor, right? When you see him like this, you think, oh, he's young, look how far he's come, look what he's done now, right? Because of all of those images in between. Probably nobody here has really ever met him or hung out with him. But you know him through all the life of those images, right? Okay, so let's go look at the paintings that somebody peed on. Our time. So the big gold one is one of Warhol, and this is kind of a funny gallery because this is where Warhol starts to make real paintings in a way. And the two smaller ones on either side, these are from these oxidation paintings of Warhol's where he painted the canvas with metallic paint and then asked somebody to urinate on it, and then the chemicals or the acid in the urine ultimately causes it to oxidize, you know, like the way a penny oxidizes. So you get these really beautiful kind of drips and expressive colors, and they almost become like this kind of newer, better, or more exciting version of abstract expressionism, right? It's like kind of like Pollock didn't think to do this because it would have been more real than using paint. I mean, this is real action. It really comes from the body. It's kind of better than, he kind of outdoes Pollock, but it takes him a while to get, you know, he gets there a few decades later. But what I want you to think about, this is why we started in front of the Motherwell, in part because think about Motherwell's drips and splatters as being these references to real energy and real brushstrokes. And this is the real version of that. This doesn't reference anything. You know, this is without reference. It's a direct result of what it is. And so to me, these are the most kind of real thing in the whole space. And they have a real beauty to them too, right? And then the same thing happens with the Rorschach paintings because this kind of gets into like a Jasper Johns flag idea, but they're Rorschach paintings, but they, in a way, you can't really make a painting of a Rorschach because it just is a Rorschach, right? Like in the same way that Jasper Johns, this is where the whole idea of a representation or a reference gets complicated and kind of great. But you can't make a painting of an American flag because it just becomes an American flag. An American flag is already a graphic, you know, it's already stripes in a square with these shapes on it. So to make a painting of that, you end up making stripes in a square with shapes on it, right? You can't really reference a flag, you end up making a flag, right? Because a flag is already not a real, you know, kind of thing in the physical world. It's a graphic thing. Does that make any kind of sense? It's kind of, I don't know, it's like, it's good stuff to think about when you're driving. just like, you know. Let's look at the camouflage. This is a gorgeous, these pieces are really funny too. So let's go look at these camouflage. So the camouflage paintings, you know, Warhol did a lot of these, and they're really beautiful. And, you know, I mean, camouflage at this point in our culture, just because of fashion and images of war and, you know, just the permutations of camouflage in the digital age, you know, there's now a digital camouflage, it looks like pixelated camouflage, has such a funny life. But what I think is great, too, I mean, this piece is so good on so many levels, but first of all, it's a landscape painting, right? So, like, this is Warhol's version of a countryside in a funny way. Like, this is his kind of pastoral countryside landscape painting in a sense. And, you know, what it's important to think about is where camouflage comes from and why. And so camouflage, of course, is this way of blending into the landscape, and camouflage is also this way of kind of averaging out the landscape, right? So it's a way of kind of like making consumable and making mass, it's kind of a way to mass consume or to mass produce, really, the landscape, right? Because all of those shapes are attempting to average out the shapes in nature, right? To kind of take all of the possible shapes and patterns and colors in nature and give them an average that would apply to a lot of situations. So it's also the landscape that can be mass consumed, like a Coke bottle, right? I mean, this is kind of like the Coke bottle version of the landscape, which I think is really beautiful. And also important to think about, again, like this idea that camouflage has this incredible life apart from, first of all, the war, and then aside from that, from the real landscape, right? You know, and it's always a little twisted when I think when camouflage enters the fashion world, but again, like you can still love it, but you can also understand that it's kind of scary. I don't know, and I think you really can sit in front of it like a landscape painting. You can kind of like feel like you're looking out into a field. So, well, let's go into the next gallery for just a few seconds. We'll just kind of go there on our way. How are we doing? So you guys don't sit down because I don't want to spend much time in here, but I think probably the curator of the show did something funny with like guns and hunting and the camouflage on the other side, but of course it's like purple camouflage. And then look out of the corner of your right eye as you're walking and look at the Martin Bradford painting, which has a skull in it, but it's like it's a collaged skull. You see it down there on the left? Mm-hmm. So let's go, and we're going to go, I think we have to backtrack a little and look at the, actually we're going to stop in here and then we're going to go look at the teeth. So some of the paintings in this space are actually, and in the next space are these collaborations that Warhol did with other artists. And I'm actually going to sort of ignore those because what I'm more interested in is these little black and white images. And they're, I think they're really beautiful. And actually, I think Warhol is picking up on some of the kind of energy of these other artists and some of the kind of associative properties of these other artists, meaning, you know, you can have this reference that enters and that moves out into culture, and then it can kind of have this more fluid, personal, kind of emotional existence. And so this little grid of ads over here are things that Warhol's pulled out of the paper and made these tracings or drawings of and then have them made into silk screens. So I think what they're evidence of, more than the ad itself, is Warhol's love of the ad and the image, right? So first of all, the act of tracing and drawing is kind of an act of love already because you have to spend time with something, right? Part of what you're seeing in all of Warhol's work that involves imagery, which of course is much of it, is his love of images and his love of culture and his love of collecting. So when you there's an image of this in the book, The Caliper of the Show, but have any of you guys been to the Warhol Museum? I used to live in Pittsburgh, so I went there a lot, but in the Warhol Museum, they have on one of the floors these pieces or these, you know, kind of objects of his called time capsules. Do you guys know about these? Some of you? And they're these cardboard boxes, and they have them in this kind of archive room that it's glass so you can see in, but they're just these shelf upon shelf of these cardboard boxes. And so what Warhol would do every once in a while is take everything off of his desk, just swipe everything off of his desk into a box, label it with the month and the year, and store it. And then he would let, and so, you know, and every once, they're going through these and archiving every object in the box, and then they'll kind of show the contents of one of the boxes. And so the really notorious one is that they found a piece of cake in one of them. So he was obviously, you know, he's eating something. So, but there'll be like a letter from, you know, Liza Minnelli, and then a postcard of the Grand Canyon, and then, you know, all kinds of notes and magazines and everything. So what I think that, first of all, just the idea of the boxes themselves and this notion of archiving or saving, you can think of it as a little bit, I mean, it's a little bit kooky to kind of save and hang on to all of these things. But what I think it can, or what I hope it can make you kind of love and question is why we save and collect anything and what our relationship to all of these things are anyway. I mean, the easiest one to think of is like photos or photo albums, right? But think of anything someone collects or think of the things that you kind of obsessively hang on to, not even obsessively, because I think that gets a little bit too overblown, that idea. But, you know, all of these things that we hold on to, like, you know, I have magazine ads from 10 years ago, and I just can't let them go. And it's this, they're evidence of this kind of love, but it's a love of something that's not there, right? It's a love of the reference or that kind of intermediate thing. And so what I think you see with these is, you know, Warhol's love of the ad, and then the time of drawing and even kind of editing, because, you know, he leaves out part of Reagan's name there. He leaves in, you know, Reagan's haircut, which is kind of funny, is, you know, his love of that image or the impact of the ad or the impact of the text. But then if you look at, you know, the content of these, it's this pretty, you know, odd kind of metaphysical, you know, there's these things about the body, about religion, about government, and then he, of course, includes a soup can, which is kind of a reference to himself. You know, like, is that Warhol making a drawing of a Campbell soup ad or of one of his own works in an art magazine, right? And at this point, it kind of doesn't matter. And then this next piece, which this work has a kind of a great memory for me, again, because of living in Pittsburgh and going to the Warhol Museum, but they have a room at the Warhol Museum that just has this one kind of mural-like painting of Warhol's, and it's dark, and it's a black light painting of his, so it uses, like, neon day glow paint, and the room is lit with a black light. And it's a big image of Christ, and then also these be a somebody with a body images. And they kind of, these works are oftentimes talked about, first of all, the kind of bodybuilding imagery, which comes about in the 70s, and especially the 80s, and gym culture, and Olivia Newton-John, and all that good stuff. But you can think about, like, this idea of, well, first of all, I love the Christ looking down on the bodybuilder and the bodybuilder looking up to Christ, but, you know, think about what's so, the whole reason that Christ is important as a religion is because he was a body, right? He became a human body. So this is actually kind of like the body of Christ and the body of man. It's actually, I mean, and Warhol would have, he gets it, you know, he knows this, right? So this is actually this very kind of like odd, poignant thing of, and this is not Jesus, right? It's an image of Jesus, right? So, you know, we're not seeing him in a piece of toast or something, but it's like, you know, so this is a painting of an image of Christ and a painting of an image of man. So it's like how these ideas enter into the culture of images and how we relate to them and consume them, right? So I think that's actually this kind of oddly serious and also kind of goofy thing, like the idea of the bodybuilder as the ultimate body, the idea of Jesus as the ultimate body, right? These two ideal physical corporeal bodies. What's the time? Let's go look at this other one with the teeth real fast. This is a piece that Warhol did with Basquiat, I think just Basquiat. And this is a work that comes out of these kind of moments when Warhol's doing these collaborative works with Basquiat and Clemente and Schnabel. And so you can see that you would guess, and it's, I don't know if we really know this, but you would guess that Warhol silk screened on the image of the dentures, and then Basquiat finishes it out with the skull and the teeth underneath. So, you know, Basquiat kind of improvises and attaches onto this idea of, you know, a piece of the, you know, this fake piece of the skeleton of the skull, and kind of rebuilds it back around it, but with a little bit of some of these kind of what people at times think of as these kind of tribal references or these mass references of Basquiat's. And this piece I love. I actually don't love a lot of their collaborative stuff because I'm just personally not a big Basquiat fan. But what I do think is exciting about this, and which taps into this thing that I love, is, again, the fluidity of this image, right? And that this image, for some people, when it enters the world of images and this kind of fluid world of references and representations, for some people, this is dentures, and it is a real thing, and it's about eating and about the body and a prosthesis. And for someone else, it becomes a skull, and it becomes a sign of, you know, aging and mortality and the body. And for some people, it will be just a really beautiful shape, right? But what I think this shows is that, and this is what Basquiat actually does kind of well, is he kind of improvises and free associates based on, you know, all of these images and connections. So I just think this kind of illustrates that notion really well. And I really do love this painting. I think it's pretty.
Do you know what the significance of 50 is?
I don't know what the significance of 50 is, but it shows up a lot. Do you know, Terry? He was born in 28, so it wouldn't be, no. So should we? I know. That's also what I don't like about Basquiat, is it's so free associative that it's hard to. I mean, you're like, okay, an envelope and an African mask and a crown. Like, I don't know. You can only free associate so much on your own. You know, like I don't know. It's just Warhol's a little more, you know, driven when he does that kind of thing. So let's go look at the Jesuses. There's always more than one Jesus. You've got it. He is multiple and all omnipresent. So, so you guys, we're going to kind of finish up here, and I think there are three pieces. I just want to look at these three because I think they're really pretty striking, but the two Da Vinci Last Summer images and then the giant, you know, yellow on, what did I say?
The
112 Jesus image, which is essentially a big mural in the next room. And then also the other image over here that has some of the kind of mural-like painting that has some of the religious content. But this, first of all, the two Last Supper paintings here, I think this is a fantastic painting. And I just want to ask you that question again, like, why is there two of them? Like, why is two better than just one? Because, I mean, it is better than one, right? Two of that kind of, like, acidic yellow images, they just are better than one somehow. And what I think also happens with these multiples is that it makes you very aware that Warhol is making a painting about the image of the painting than the actual painting. And the source of this painting, and then the essay in the catalog makes this very clear, the source of the image of this painting wasn't a photograph that Warhol took, but one that he got from a book, right? So, you know, it's, again, he's already, like many of us, accessing these works of art through books and images. So it's about the image of the painting and about his relationship to it through books and images. And when there's two, it becomes even more about the image, right? Because once you have a multiple of something, you know that there's not an original. Does that seem really, really straightforward? Right. I mean, once there's more than one, there's not an original. Once there's more than one, there can be an infinite number. Of course, this relates to minimalism too, but so I was kind of obsessed with this painting when I was here earlier. I was like, God, why is two so good? Like, why? It's like, is it one for each eye? Like, is it just that means there's like more of it? Like, you know, each of your eyes gets one. It's like more, you know, it's like having two desserts or something. So I just think it's such a compelling image. And it also lets you kind of compare the silk screen in each one. Like, you kind of get the sense that you need to be focusing on some details that may or may not be there. And then really one of the, I think this is this painting over here is brilliant. And this, to me, shows some of the influence of Basquiat, like this kind of free association. So come up to the, let's go up over here. Sorry. So I'm sure it doesn't take much to see this painting as a big religious mural, right? Like I could easily see this in a church and it would look beautiful and it would have as much meaning as, you know, a Renaissance painting, you know, a very narrative mural in a Renaissance church. And I mean, they're just such beautiful and kind of complicated references. And it really shows that like all, the world of images is this, you know, fluid and powerful thing. So, you know, of course, the primary image here is the image of Jesus, but then you've got 699, which of course is like 666, right? So you have this kind of weird presence of the devil, and you know, and also the fluidity of that idea of the 666, and the fact that you can actually see that price in a newspaper and kind of like chuckle to yourself and have that reference, and that's kind of a powerful thing, right? The fact that you can see something that's the price of a piece of steak and it have this weird kind of, you're like your brain has this weird flutter to some other very serious thing, and then you kind of move back to the newspaper. You know, I mean, I think that shows, you know, just how densely, you know, kind of layered and soupy all of this stuff is, right? And then you have like some of these logos. They don't have one of the paintings in the show, but in some of these paintings, there's the Dove soap logo, which is really beautiful. So like the idea that a bar of soap, which is this thing that you buy to take a shower with, has a dove on it, you know, and has this kind of spiritual reference, or, you know, maybe this is the Holy Spirit, and, you know, or the eye of God, and the eagle is the Holy Spirit, right? Like, they're all, you know, and the fact that the eagle can reference all of these things, right? I mean, it can reference Harley Davidson, it can reference a dollar bill, it can also conjure these, you know, more religious or metaphysical ideas, but ultimately that image has all of that power in it, and it's a fluid thing. It's not a fixed thing. So I think there's this kind of, like, odd kind of beauty and power to that. And I don't know what to make of the bike other than maybe that's like the rebellious son who gets a motorcycle and does something really dangerous. I don't know. Maybe somebody has a better idea. The other one that I love is some of these images have the GE logo in it. And, you know, the GE tagline is "We bring good things to life." So I kind of love that on an image of Jesus. It like, you know, it just like all of that stuff is so, it just all happens at the same time, right? It just, and it's good to kind of love that all happens at once in our lives, and to know that we're always kind of moving around in that soup of all that stuff. And then the big C is hysterical, right? Like the big C. Don't you want to start calling Jesus the big C now? Like, that's kind of like, it would just, it's good. It's like his, you know, his football team name or something. And you guys just, if you scoot back, there's the TV that's showing Warhol's interview show in that room, so I don't want to talk next to it, but I just want to read you two more quotes while we're looking at this kind of last image of all of the images of Jesus. Is that too close to the thing? So, you know, again, I just wanted to, let me find these, whoops. So, you know, I kind of asked this question when we were looking at the Mona Lisa, and so this is a piece that is, of course, very similar to those Mona Lisa images in a way because, you know, it's a multiple, it has a grid of all of these images, and it also brings up this idea of, you know, like, why is there more than one of something, and why is having multiples and a grid of multiples better, or somehow, why is there so much meaning in having more than one and not just one of those images? And this is an older quote from Warhol. Some of you guys know this, but it's one of my favorites. I'm going to read you two quotes, one that's kind of goofy and one that's, I think, kind of sweeter. So this is the goofy one. So Warhol says, what's great about this country is that America started the tradition where the richest consumers buy essentially the same thing as the poorest. You can be watching TV and see a Coca-Cola, and you know that the president drinks Coke, Liz Taylor drinks Coke, and just think you can drink Coke too. A Coke is a Coke, and no amount of money can get you a better Coke than the one the bum on the corner is drinking. All the Cokes are the same, and all the Cokes are good. Liz Taylor knows it, the president knows it, the bum knows it, and you know it. So I just love that, and like this idea of multiples, and like multiples in a funny way are this kind of leveling thing, and of course they're so American. And then, I've got the screaming in the background. I don't think it's somebody looking at the work. So, and then this is an interview from 63, and this is this very sweet and direct quote. He says, Warhol says, "I think everybody should like everybody." And the interviewer says, "Is that what pop art is all about?" And Warhol says, "Yes, it's liking things." So I just think that's really, you know, like, ultimately when you see these kind of multiples and all these, it's like, it's about this kind of, he's like, yes, it's liking things. You know, it's about loving something and making an image. And if you really love something, you make more than one, right? So it's just like this kind of like, you just want more of something. Anyway, I just think that, I don't know, I love both of those quotes. Like, Jesus is the same thing as a Coca-Cola, and that's actually really smart, but it's also about liking things. So kind of good that way. Anyway, thanks, you guys. If you have any questions, let me know.